Each failure is a step closer to success. You're listening to episode 5 of Learn With Us. I'm Ken.
And I'm Nikos. Learn With Us is a podcast for developers that want to learn how to teach programming.
Good morning, Nikos.
Good evening, Ken.
Today we were going to talk about module import syntax and using the import syntax in a browser.
Yep.
And you've been playing around with that. You were going to start with your Solr pop-up.
Yeah, that's correct. I created a folder in my demo folder on that project. So Solr pop-up /demos/ browser import or something. So what I'd done there was I had a TS config that output ES2015. And then I tried to load that in the browser. And the first thing that I discovered was it didn't work because the browser expects a .js file extension on the import statements. But when TypeScript transpiles the TypeScript to ES 2015, it doesn't include the JavaScript file extension. But if I do it manually, it seems to work. So what I'm doing now is I'm just writing a little CLI tool that will take a directory and then add the file extensions to all the import statements. So you can run it. Yeah, so you can run it after the TSC command.
But when TSC runs, it recognizes that file and transpiles it. Is that right?
Well, it just behaves as normal, and then you can modify the files after it transpiles.
Right. And it's using the import function type of... you're not doing like a normal ES2015 import. You're doing the import function.
No. This isn't a normal ES15 import.
It didn't work the way that you thought it should. So what are you doing now?
Well, I also went on to GitHub and I was talking to Daniel, and there was another issue that was quite similar to it.
Mm-hmm.
And they've added a few labels to it, so they're kind of thinking of supporting it, but I think originally there wasn't really, they didn't think it would have been too much of an idea, but I think they're working on what we're thinking of that will be good to support that syntax. So what I'm doing is I'm just writing a Node CLI tool that will... So I'm basically looping through the files and having a regex expression to find the import statements. And then it's quite a simple find replace. Just adding .js to the module name. Another thing that I'll have to try and figure out is how I'm going to load my CSS, because the Solr pop-up library at the moment bundles everything into a JavaScript file, including the PCSS. PCSS is a file extension for PostCSS. It's like a sort of standards-based extension to CSS language. So at the moment, Webpack is bundling all that into it, but I'm not sure how that's going to work with him doing it this way.
Right, your Webpack is kind of the build tool, essentially, and it does the bundling of the JavaScript when you're dealing with CommonJS, but when you take that out of the equation, what's Webpack doing? I guess there is other features of Webpack that could still exist in your project.
Yeah.
Just it wouldn't be touching your JavaScript anymore.
Well, the nice thing about Webpack is that it's compiling this PC, post CSS and the TypeScript at the same time and then just sticking it into this output. Now, you know, Webpack is kind of a learning curve to learn how to use it. So I was like, can I get away from Webpack just by running the TypeScript compiler and then loading the files in the browser. But then I've got to figure out how I'm going to get my CSS over there as well. So I hope I have to have another build step within maybe npm scripts. So I've got to be careful that my move away from build tools doesn't end up being more complicated in the long term.
Yeah, I mean, I've been down that road before when trying to step away from Gulp, you know, and just use npm scripts. It turned out that I had to write my own, you know, SAS tool, and you know, the Gulp SAS plugin worked perfectly. But so when you pull out of when you stop using these build tools, you might be compromising quite a bit to get away from the tool. In the regards of the ES6 modules, or the, you know, the next generation of modules, I think it's a good thing to start pushing these, you know, like TypeScript, pushing it towards the using it the way the specs call for it.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you're taking the charge on that.
If you go into the TypeScript repository on GitHub, the issue is it's github.com/microsoft/typescript/issues/16577, and they've put a few labels on there. They've put a suggestion label, a news proposal label, and a new one called domain ES modules. I guess that's the real name for it, ES modules, right?
Yeah, I'm looking at a blog post that says ES proposal import dynamic modules. Uh-huh. Dynamically importing ES modules.
Uh-huh.
This blog post was from January, but there's also a GitHub repository for dynamic import of modules.
Uh-huh.
So I'll put the links in the show notes for these.
I think my use case here is like static import. Everything's known at the start, whereas dynamic could actually be the proper use case for this stuff, I think. Cause...
Oh, right. So like the dynamic thing that I'm calling out here might be different than what you're doing, right?
Yeah, well, the dynamic thing is a new thing, isn't it, in TypeScript? Whereas what I'm trying to do is I'm just trying to have the app runs at runtime and just imports everything it needs at that time, I guess.
Right. The dynamic imports, as far as I understand, they operate similar to the async keyword or a promise. I think the mm-hmm. import function returns a promise, so that you can have a hook into when that script or that module is loaded.
So what was the highlight of your coding week then?
Oh, the highlight of my coding week. So I got into some .NET stuff that I'm unfamiliar with. So there's some COM libraries, I think that's what they're called, where essentially you're talking to, there's DLLs that you communicate to, and you don't have any real insight into what, the API is, and you just kind of have to read documentation to find out what the heck you're doing.
Yeah.
And then hope the application doesn't throw an error.
I'm so glad they don't have DLLs in JavaScript, man.
Yeah. So, luckily, we don't have to worry about that. I imagine that you could get down that far where you would need DLLs in JavaScript if you were doing something pretty low level. But
well, I think JavaScript's heading in a sort of low-level direction with all this assembly language JavaScript stuff.
Yeah, like what you're talking, like WebAssembly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that stuff is quite interesting. Did we talk about that already?
No, I don't think.
You take like so. Rust code. You could take Rust code or Go code, and it could compile down to WebAssembly, or I don't know if that's just C.
But yeah.
Essentially, you have a single like executable that you could run in the browser, which is quite interesting.
What do you think about these non-JavaScript light languages just compiling to JavaScript? Do you think it's dangerous, hard to
like
maintain?
Elm, you mean?
Like Elm, like Java, like whatever, or, you know, that's compiling to JavaScript code.
I mean, it's not, the concept's not much different than TypeScript, right? I mean, the idea is that, hey, you're going to write code and the browser's going to run JavaScript. So it's not too far off from what TypeScript is doing. However, TypeScript's language is based off of JavaScript, whereas these other languages like Elm and I can't remember, there's some other ones, but they're not, as far as I remember, they're not based off of the language of TypeScript or JavaScript, but you can use JavaScript in them because you have to be able to access or, you know, use third-party libraries, so you must be able to write some sort of JavaScript abstraction inside of your Elm project. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to call the APIs of the third-party libraries.
Yeah. I think a lot of these things like Elm and Java and C++, whatever, to JavaScript, they're nice, they maybe work really well, they maybe make things easier to use, but I think the amount of people using them is so small compared to the larger JavaScript community that I just don't really take them seriously.
Well, yeah, I mean, they do have a smaller adoption rate, right? That being said, the organizations that are using these libraries or these they're not libraries, these languages, they have a really niche use case, or they want to have complete control over how, like, the style and how it's created. And then the developers working on it, they're going to be highly skilled in this really niche language. So if ever there is a application built in Elm, there's only going to be a handful of people to select from to work on it. That might change over time. It's pretty early. So yeah.
But those things just get really hard to maintain if the developers stop using that language or move away from, you know. You just end up with a really legacy code base, I think, in those situations. Because, like, I think like, framework fatigue is a really big factor, and that's one of the biggest reasons why Node and JavaScript is becoming so popular, not because it's such a great language, it's because it's so ubiquitous.
And it's growing over time. One of the nicest things about JavaScript is that it's backwards compatible, and everything that you wrote 15, 20 years ago will execute on today's runtime.
Right? Absolutely,
so it's
yeah.
It's not like they're stripping away a whole bunch of APIs constantly. Granted, the DOM API might be changing, and we might lose abilities to add blink tags at some point, but the JavaScript portion of that is not really changing all that much.
Yeah.
I mean, they're adding to it, and mostly it's just syntactic sugar sitting on top of prototypal JavaScript. But you still have the same old JavaScript that you had 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah. That's one of the reasons why I'm trying to write things in Vanilla and JavaScript. Although I do, the more that I do write stuff in Vanilla JavaScript, the more I appreciate things like what React is doing with the state management and components. You know, it's like, I think the more I write my vanilla stuff, the more I realize I'm kind of making something to copy, like what React is doing. So I don't know, I'm still haven't decided yet. But I think vanilla JavaScript is good for standalone components that don't do that much.
There's so many times where I feel like I'm about to write Lodash or underscore.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to have this. It's just this utility library that I really like and I use quite a bit. And once I start to use one or two components of, you know, I've written a couple of custom, you know, helper functions that will get me part of an array or, you know, kind of extract pieces of an object. And then I think, well, I should just bring in Lodash or bring in underscore. For one, I don't have to write that boilerplate code anymore. And for two, I don't have to test that code. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I know what you're saying, writing vanilla JavaScript, but, you know, also with bringing in these third-party libraries is you don't have to test that code. As long as you trust where it came from, you don't have to test it.
Mm-hmm.
Which, depending on if you write unit tests, that might be a moot point.
So I've also been playing around with Firebase this week again. They've got pretty neat ways to authenticate users. They have like emails that can be sent out for usernames, passwords, reset.
They connect you to social profiles too, right?
Yeah. And I'm trying to also understand their database rules. You have a sort of rules file, and then you have ways of like writing your validation rules into the actual database layer. Instead of having like a server-side validation, you can do everything. You can validate the data at the database level, which is really nice.
Right. And you can set roles on documents, I guess.
I'm still learning it.
Or roles on collections. I think that's what they call them. They call them collections, don't they? Like instead of calling it a table, it's a collection.
I think so.
Yeah, I really like what Firebase is doing. Rather than, you know, going standing up a MongoDB instance, and you have the database there, and you have all that authentication and rules to go along with it. So
yeah, Firebase is for me the best for indie developers. If you're a big corporate client, then yeah, go ahead and use AWS. But you need to hire specialists in that, and I just don't have time to learn how to use AWS properly.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on buying into a proprietary framework like Firebase? Like, you couldn't necessarily export what you have in Firebase and then take it over to another service that does exactly the same thing, because it's not a standard, right?
Yeah. Well, I guess if you write your front end in a way that is back end agnostic, then you should be all right. Because, like, in Ember, you can use Ember data with Firebase, what's called Ember Fire. And
yeah, I'm not familiar. Is it Ember really data, like, is it just like an abstraction for your API? Yeah, okay.
And also has an abstraction for the API, so you use the same code to work with items from the store there and stuff like that. Okay, there's a bit of, like, custom code for, like, log authentication, but it's not that much. You know, it's like firebase.signin, you know, and then the models for the routes and stuff, you just get that item from the store, then it goes to look up Firebase.
What's have you played around with AWS Lambda?
Yeah, I have.
Did you just? Yeah, so that's like one-off, like, function cloud computing, right? Like, once you can hit it.
That's correct. Function as a service, it's called.
Right. Yeah, Azure has that too, and I haven't messed around with that, but I'm interested to see what you can do with it. What have you used it for?
Well, I was just building some demo apps and some tutorials. I was using this thing called Serverless Framework, but it wasn't really obvious to me how to debug things, and there was just there's so many things to have to, like, keep the track of, and you had different zones and different. I just find the console kind of like a maze to navigate. I mean, I'm sure if I spent so much time, you know, I would eventually get used to it. And apparently, well, serverless framework makes it easier.
Right.
But yeah, there's still a big learning curve, so I'm just like, I'll stick with Firebase.
Yeah. Well, one of the new things that just got announced today, today is June 20th, here where I'm at. And Azure has now a document DB service, or not, sorry, not document DB, MongoDB. Document DB is already in Azure because that's a Microsoft product, but uh-huh. MongoDB is now a service that can be used within Azure. So I'm interested in that because there's been so many times where I've wanted to just kind of spin up. I have credit on Azure, and I was just like, I just want to spin up an instance of MongoDB and poke around with it because I haven't really explored it too much. And it'd be nice to just kind of play around with it. The document DB pricing model is a little bit too steep, so I'd like to stay away from document DB.
What's document DB?
It's Microsoft's document storage, NoSQL offering. Mm-hmm. So I've kind of the idea of quick or real-time transactions is kind of what DocumentDB is good at.
Mm-hmm.
When you watch the videos and like the promotional stuff that they talk about, it's usually about like real-time games that use it to quickly store state.
Yeah.
But I haven't found a real good use case.
Well, another topic, Brexit seems to be kicking off again.
Yeah, so are you guys like going to detach from the Union? Like, the island's going to shift away?
It's just such a big, massive, confusing process, and it's like a stalemate. It's like the EU needs Britain for trade, but the EU, the leaders are kind of like, I think they're a bit... they don't like Brexit, and they don't want to, like, they're trying to just force Britain into a corner. It's just a really big, confusing mess. I'm so glad I'm not working as a negotiator in that. It's just, yeah. It would just give you a big, massive headache. Because you imagine being a negotiator for Brexit, right? You come over here, the public's all, like, wanting the best deal, you know, expecting you to get the best deal. You're in the parliament, you're talking to the ministers, you're feeling confident. Then you go over to Brussels and sit down with all the I can't say Eurocrats, but the people in the power in the Parliament, EU Parliament, and then they all just gang up on you, and it's embarrassing, man. It's,
you're one person in the midst of these, you know, 30
yeah.
countries or however many. How many countries are in the European Union?
No idea, man. That's how much we care about it in the UK. I think we had like a couple of years ago, I had a couple of extra countries join. I mean, I think it was like, I don't know, Croatia or Slovenia or Moldova or something like that. But
well, when you're part of the European Union, you have common currency, right? You have common currency, and you're pretty much free to travel within the.
Oh European yeah, that's the best bit about it: trade and free travel. A lot of tech companies are worried about it because they're going to find it hard to get talent. A lot of programmers in London are, or the good, best programmers are actually from the EU.
Yeah, that's what's happening over here with the, you know, the travel ban that we're experiencing.
Oh, really?
Or they've been trying to have a travel ban. Have you not heard of this? That there's like 7 or 8. Middle East nations that the United States is.
And you get a lot of programmers from there.
Yeah, there's a lot of programmers from a lot of places, and then not only that, but we're also putting a ban on laptops coming into the United States, or they have to try. I can't remember exactly what the laptop rule, but laptops have to be stored in the lug, or they can't be carry on. Or so, I'm not exactly sure. I don't travel, so I don't need to know.
Yeah.
But the people that do know don't want to come to the United States because they don't know if they're going to be able, like, if they leave, can they come back? You know, there's some people that are here on visas, and if they leave, can they come back? And, you know, Google and Apple and Microsoft and all these big companies are, they get a lot of candidates for jobs because they look all over the globe for these people.
Yeah, yeah. I think most of the people on Facebook are, a lot of Asian developers and Indian developers there. You know, some of the best programmers are from India and China.
Yeah, so we're just shutting the doors on a bunch of, you know, really highly qualified people, and it's gonna hurt the world economy, not just the United States economy.
So I mean,
we'll see how
tech talent is like being like a Mozart or a Bach. It's like there's not that many of them, you know, and some of those really really talented programmers, then. If you don't have access to that market, then it's going to be tough for them, tough for the States, tough for the UK as well.
Yeah. One of the nice things about working on the internet is that we can almost work from anywhere.
That's true, yeah.
You know, there's like the digital nomad movement, so you can essentially be employed by a company in the United States, but still live or work remotely in other countries. So you want to travel to Japan, that's fine. Go travel to Japan and you can work. But you have, there's legalities about it. Like you have to come back into the United States like every 6 months or something like that. And you have to be here for a certain amount of time before you can leave again.
It's a bit of a grey area to me because I can't go to America and work for a company, but I can do remote work for them, I guess. But then if they want me to go over and help them, you know, for a week or two, does that mean I need to get a visa for that? I haven't actually worked out with the government what's going to happen there, but
worth looking into. You know, I've definitely felt like I could easily just spend the summer at the coast or something. you know, work is I don't go into the office enough to make it I went into the office today and had a few face-to-face conversations, but those face-to-face conversations could have happened on Slack. They didn't have to happen in person. The people I work with, I enjoy working with them, but there was nothing like super important that they couldn't be handled remotely.
I could even do training online. Once I get because like there's only so many people I can meet in a Starbucks. Like so, when I'm out playing football in the park and that, I talk to people. Sometimes I say, you know, what do you do for a living? And they'll say like, oh, I'm a chef or whatever. Well, the chef's a good job. My dad's a chef. But then I'll say, do you ever thought about being a programmer? Or a web developer, and about 90%, 95% of the time, they'll say no, right? But you get the odd person that is interested, and so I'll be willing to like meet them, take them to Starbucks, show them some stuff on their laptop. But I guess it's not scalable, so like, if I had like 50 developers that are, you know, wanting to learn code, then I could always do like an online seminar, or you could even do it for companies as well if they want. That personal touch, because there's a difference between putting out videos on YouTube or even selling videos than actually teaching in real time.
There's a sense that when you're teaching in real time, you have a captive audience, right? But when you are creating these videos before anybody asks for them, and then you go back weeks later and you're, you know, still at less than 10 views or something like that, you're like, whoa, what did I just waste my time on? So there's that little bit of doubt, like, is this going to be good? But You also have to know that it takes time. You need to market, and you always need to show up. So if you're going to produce content like a video, it's not going to just magically go viral, right? You're going to have to promote it, have to find people that are looking for, that are having trouble in that specific area, and get them interested. You know, they're not going to go out and seek that video out.
I just think there's a huge market for people just to train people. There's so many companies out there that just, they would save so much money if they just got trainers and to train their staff.
Oh yeah, yeah. We were talking about this at the office today, and this is one of those conversations that I guess I probably wouldn't have had through Slack, but we were talking about, you know, how do we, as a company, be a better, or how we get better at TDD as a company as a whole? Like, we know bits and pieces. We implement it when we hand off the project to our clients. How are we handing it off in a way that they continue with the TDD? There's no real set process in any of our projects, and sometimes we get projects that have no tests in it, you know, because we're a consultancy, so we might take on this, you know, this old project that has nothing in it, and what do we do at that point? Do we start putting in tests, or, you know, we just don't have anything documented, no structure to it. So if we had somebody in-house that was really good at TDD, that might be one thing. But if we also brought in a trainer that gave us a week of their time, and then we just built that process with the trainer, we'd have it set, and then we wouldn't be able to forget.
Yes, great investment, because a trainer can leverage himself. He can train 5 or 6 people at once, or, you know, 8 at once, and if he's there for a week, he can learn so much. And even though it might be it might cost twice as much as a normal, you know, person you hire, then it's worth it, because you're just sort of multiplying your skill base.
Right. That 1 week of time is going to pay for itself over the next year. Yeah. Well, it looks like we're getting near the end of our time here.
Yes. Yeah, must be late over there. It's almost 12 o'clock.
Yeah, we're almost at midnight. So, well, thanks, Nikos. This has been fun. And thank you for listening, dear listener. You've been listening to Learn With Us.
Yes.
You can find us on Twitter at LearnWithUsPod. Yep. And go to iTunes and give us a 5-star review.
Thank you very much.
If you have any questions, use the hashtag LearnJavaScript. And then we'll answer your questions on our podcast. See you next week.
See you guys.
A reading of If Hemingway Wrote JavaScript by Agnes Kroll. The Variable After the Raven by Edgar Allan Poe. Once upon a midnight dreary, while I struggled with jQuery, sighing softly, weak and weary, troubled by my daunting chore, while I grappled with weak mapping, suddenly a function wrapping formed a closure, gently trapping objects that had gone before. Ah, distinctly I remember, it was while debugging Ember, as each separate dying member left its host forevermore. Eagerly I wished the morrow, vainly I had sought to borrow from my bookmarked trail of sorrow APIs from underscore. There I sat engaged in guessing the meaning of each cursed expression. Endless callbacks in procession, nameless functions, nothing more. This and more I sat divining, strength and spirit fast declining. Disclose the value we're assigning. Tell me, I implore.